What's my most favorite thing to do? To talk. Every week I'll do just that. We'll feature national and international movers and shakers, experts in their fields, and all around interesting people with something more than great to say. No holds barred. We'll tackle every topic imaginable, especially for women over 40. This is Conversations with Sima. Please stay tuned.
When you go to business school these days, and I teach at business school, the first lesson is the purpose of a business. And they always say the purpose of a business is to make money and increase stockholder value. It's wrong. The purpose of the business is to serve the needs of our fellow human beings. When we have that as the primary purpose, we will have love and compassion, and the outcome will be good in terms of business.
We've just heard Deepak Chopra talking about compassion in business. Today we'll be talking with a customer service consultant passionate about helping businesses create compassionate workplaces, which in turn produce stellar customer experiences and result in an increase in profitable sales. Monica Tarr is the founder and CEO of Bennett Bay Consulting. Some of her clients have been Blue Cross Blue Shield, Northwest Bank, and Alaska's largest telecom provider, GCI. She is also a part-time yoga teacher. Her consulting company was spawned after personal transformation, which occurred during yoga teacher training, when her teachers challenged the students to put the yoga practices to the test in the real world. Monica decided her corporate job was the toughest laboratory to test the power of compassion. The results were overwhelmingly positive. So welcome, Monica.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your journey to your present incarnation.
It was something that was unplanned. I had been studying yoga for about 6 or 7 years and wanted to take a teacher training journey just for my own personal growth, with not really too many goals about what I would do afterward. And what I found was a huge personal transformation, something that if people around me noticed and would talk about, they didn't really know why, but my husband would make comments that I was looking more relaxed and I wasn't losing my temper as much, and people at work were just commenting about how organized I was and how nice it was to work with me and how I always keep my promises and stick to my deadlines and things like that. So I thought, this is really something that's going to have far-reaching effects on my life. And as you said in the intro, what I was challenged with from our teachers during the training was not to accept what they were saying just blindly and on faith, but to take the teachings out and truly put them into practice and work with them, experiment with them, see what worked for us, what we could blend into our own daily lives, and work with our own personalities in a unique way. So as you said in the intro, I did that, and I thought there's really no more difficult place than I can fool around with these practices than at work, where people typically don't get along with each other. There's, you know, backbiting and promises not kept and those types of things. So I thought that's going to be my laboratory, and I'm going to play with these principles and see what happens and challenge them and see if they are as true and as impactful as the teacher said that they would be.
So how did you come to the present incarnation of wanting to take this forward into your job and then moving it forward into your own consulting work?
So I took a couple of the key practices. Patience was one of them, which is not my stronger suit. And also bringing people together. And there was a journaling exercise that they asked us to do. And that was, I think, really the tipping point. So there were 10 topics in that journaling exercise that we had to reflect on and write on. They request 6 times a day, but as often as you can do it. And so what I found out during that process, that 4 of them were focused on basically your speech, what you say, the intention that you have behind what you're saying, et cetera. And so I really concentrated on those and stuck to my journaling for the longest period of time that I ever had. And what I found out for myself and my own personality is that there were many times where I would just be sarcastic or something like that, but the speech I was using was having a lot of impact, both positive. It was having a positive impact. So that what that pointed out was that it was probably having a negative impact before I changed it. So this journaling raised the awareness, and I just played with these four concepts around speech and changed my habits and kept track of what was going on. And what I noticed was that that really had the biggest effect. It had a large effect on my thoughts, but it had a large effect on how people interpreted my behavior and my ability to get things done and be a good person to work with. And that was important to me. But sooner or later, what I did find was that particular organization that I was working in was sort of limiting my ability to expand beyond this kind of playing around with these principles. And so I really felt the need to take control over that and be in a position of leadership where I get to say that these principles are at the heart of how I do work versus something I'm just playing around in a laboratory setting. And what happened was I had clients coming to look for me and asking me to do consulting for them while I still had a different job. And then that's really when the switch flipped. And I thought, you know, there's something here and I'm going to go out on my own and give this a try.
So take me into your thought processes. If you are met by a company who would like your services, what tips would you offer them or what techniques would you start with?
So the first thing that I start with after a company expresses interest is I explain to them about my methodology when I do go into an account and work with them. And it always starts with focusing on the customer. So I request a large cross-functional audience to participate, and a lot of that is because I want to get the broadest perceptions of information, but it's also because typically one of the biggest hurdles in a company that prevents them from moving forward is that they don't collaborate with each other very well. Not because they don't like each other, it's just that they don't have structures that allow them to do that. So then we start with customer journey mapping, which focuses them on the customer. And that does a couple of things, and it's really fascinating to watch in the room. So a lot of times people will enter and they're quite protective of themselves and their departments and their processes and their employees and et cetera. And it's all sort of me, me, me. All the arrows are pointing in, arms crossed, you know, very insular. And then when we start this exercise, what you see is that they literally their body language opens, they're more communicative, and you can watch their perception change from a sort of ego-based mindset when they got in there to an external mindset that they're there for the benefit of somebody else. And I don't have to be preachy about that. It's an intellectual exercise that we go through that has an interesting sociological impact. But you can watch it in the room. You can watch people's faces change. It's really interesting.
Because this work doesn't in and of itself produce profitable sales, I believe that we'll talk about that in a few minutes about how that actually at the end of the line produces positive mm-hmm. results. In the moment, though, the employers, I'm guessing, are watching this kind of transformation. But then how are you getting them to continue to buy into this? In what manner do they then say, wow, this is a positive experience for my employees. Let's move forward.
I'll just give you an example because I think it's probably the best way to illustrate. So I had a request to do this exercise along with some process mapping in gory detail. And one of the executives came and sat in the corner, far corner of the room. He just was there to observe. He didn't want to participate. He didn't want to even really have too many people in the room know that he was there because he didn't want to alter the interaction. So we're moving along with the Q&A and building out these maps, and it's going really well. There were probably 25 people in there. And we get to a part where they're describing to me a particularly painful customer process. The person who starts the description doesn't exactly know that it's painful because from their point, they're doing what they've been told to do. The process is mature, and they think they're following the rules. And then the next person adds their color to it on how it impacts them and the next person and on down the food chain. Well, when we get to the end, everybody's looking at each other and the realization dawns on them that this is a really really crummy experience for the customer. Although each one of them were doing their thing the right way, it's really negative from the standpoint of the customer. Mm-hmm. And so when I looked, I'm drawing on the board, I turn around and look toward the back of the room and see the vice president sitting in the back, and he literally has his head in his hand and he's shaking his head. Not at the people in the room, not at his employees. He's shaking his head because he couldn't believe that even though they had good intentions to serve their customers, that they created a process that was really so inconvenient. So that's how you get the leadership to buy in. Hopefully they attend, but if they don't, we're able to bring back data to them. What I tell the folks is that you don't have to try to find these problems. They jump off the paper and land on the conference room table, and everybody just sort of sits there and looks at them and nods their heads and says, we have to fix that. It's bad.
Can you give me one or two other instances where this came to light? And I'd like to find out in greater detail about a specific company where, again, you're telling me that this will find its own homeostasis. That's pretty much what you just mm-hmm. said. So give me an example of how that works. And why is it that in this type of atmosphere, it becomes easier and easier for the very bad parts of these companies' runnings, the very bad parts of the customer service that they're giving that is not positive, seem to work their way up to the surface, and then they can be worked out?
Sure. So it's a banking example, which I think that we'll all feel because we all deal with banks in some way or fashion. So this particular example, the group in the room knew that this was a problem. They just didn't know all the details. So once we drew it out and how it affects the customer and who in the organization is involved in this type of process, that's when the ugliness sort of fell on the table, and the people in the room who were working on this were relatively frontline folks. So we didn't have an executive in here, but the project was sponsored by the CMO. The particular thing that happens is, whether you know it or not, your debit card has certain limits on it. You can only spend so much money in a given time period. You can only do a certain number of transactions in a given time period, et cetera. So if you think about Christmas time, where you're out doing a lot of shopping, you can bump up against these limits. You can bump up any time, but it's pretty likely that it's going to happen. If it's going to happen, it'll happen at Christmas time. But customers don't know this because we all just grab our new debit cards and go out and live our lives. So what happens is they're typically in transit, or they're at the checkout counter when they find this out. So that in and of itself is a trigger for anger and frustration. So the process this bank had was, the customer would call into customer service, assuming customer service was still open. The agents who answer the call don't have the authority to change the limits. They can see what's going on, but they don't have the authority. So then they have to escalate it to a supervisor. Sometimes the supervisor can fix it. It depends how much they need to change. If they can't fix it, they have to send the customer to a branch. Well, branches, as we know, have pretty limited hours. So they may go to a branch maybe the next day. They stand in line and wait for the teller. The teller can't even see the activity on the ATM card. The call center can, but the teller can't. So they have to escalate to the branch manager. So I'm sure by now you can feel that this is a pretty horrible thing that happens. So I can't use my card at the checkout counter, and now I get the runaround on trying to get this thing fixed, and I don't even understand why this is happening because I had no idea these limits were on my card in the first place. So really bad situation, really, really bad. But the fixes were relatively easy. Give the tellers the right software and the right training, you know, up the power of the agent so they can resolve most problems, and then, you know, allow them to escalate to the manager, who can then do whatever the branch manager can do. And why would you make the customer ever go to a branch that has such limited hours? Well, the CMO who sponsored the project had no idea this was happening. So once we got finished drawing it, we quantified how often this happened and what the impact was to all the people involved and how much labor it took to resolve this. And once I presented it to him, he, after the shock wore off, and he asked a few questions, and he said, this is awful. I can't believe we're doing this. I'm really sorry to our customers. And it was fixed in 2 weeks.
Wow. We're talking today with a customer service consultant who's passionate about helping businesses create compassionate workplaces. Monica, tell me a little more about the techniques you would use to enhance compassion in the workplace. Do you suggest that they journal, write it down, have meetings more often? What do you offer them to start the process?
The first one is collaboration. So I recommend that they set up a regular way that they can collaborate with the same people that were in the workshop with me. So that in and of itself, and by collaborate, I mean that they meet once a month, once a quarter, once a week, whatever works for their teams and organization. And the purpose of the meeting is not to talk about their own departments or the things that are difficult for them, but it's to talk about what's happening with the customer and what is cropping up that they think is difficult for the customer, or how can they innovate ways to provide additional convenience for the customer. So it's a regular meeting of the minds to focus on an external third party. And the focus on the external third party is really the catalyst that allows them to work together more easily, because they're out of their own minds, their egos are set aside, and it just sort of happens naturally. And then the other thing that happens naturally when they start doing that is that they begin to develop compassion and empathy for each other, in understanding, oh, if I do this, then I'm going to affect Julie's apartment like this, so I need to talk to her before I make any decisions, and we need to work this out together. So they understand the food chain and the impacts they have on each other, and they've gotten to know each other, and so then now they have an open-heartedness about working together and bringing each other both up, instead of I'm in it for me, I'm going to do what's right for my own department, and I don't really care if it submarines someone else. And down the food chain, that ends up having a negative impact on the customer. So if you flip the food chain on its ear and you focus on the customer, then these other positive impacts between the employees, and it affects vendors and other third parties that they work with if they work in the same way. So it really is I call it sneaky compassion. It's an intellectual, procedural way to work together, but the end result is that it creates compassion and empathy for each other, which down the line creates more positive experiences for customers, and then that gets into the revenue increases.
How does this process not affect them when the overwhelming majority of corporations in the United States at this moment are pushing their employees beyond their limits, are forcing them to have to get more profitability in a market that is sometimes tanking, work longer hours, constantly pit themselves against other people in their divisions or departments? I'm wondering if these other unresolved residual issues don't find their way through to these meetings as well, and what do you do about it?
They do. And you can't sometimes boil the ocean either. So there's a couple ways that I see it panning out. It's much more effective when this process is started from the top down. So that speaks to leadership. So if someone, say like the CMO, is pushing for better customer experiences, or is pushing to clean up processes, or even if they're pushing for efficiencies, which is a pure cost play, And there's something happening in their competitive marketplace, or God forbid they have to reduce staff. So these processes still work in those environments, but they're much more effective if they're sponsored by somebody in the executive leadership group. It doesn't always happen, but the impacts are much greater if it happens that way. It can happen from the bottom up or by one department at a time. And what I tell folks, because they'll have frequently a pretty good experience or a great experience in these workshops, right? But these last for a couple of weeks, and then they have to go back to their day job. And sometimes it's very difficult for these groups to go back into a culture that doesn't support this kind of thinking and these kinds of approaches. And so what I encourage them to do is to kind of create a microcosm within their work group and as far as the tentacles will reach within the organization, and keep doing it. That's the, you know, like they tell us in yoga, it's a practice and it's not about getting it perfect. It's actually about the journey and about the daily practice. So that's really what I encourage them to do. We all have to come to work. We want to make it the most pleasant place possible. And if possible, we'd like to do some good in the world. I think that makes us all feel better. So if they can do this practice on a daily basis in every meeting that they have, in every conversation they have with an employee, and put these types of communications and these types of research behaviors into practice on a daily basis, it will at least keep them sane, because they'll know in their heart they're doing the right thing. At best, it will spread, and they will be seen as a leader and a change maker in their organization, and that will benefit them from a personal standpoint. But if they, for example, if they have employees, it will benefit their team also. So it's not always possible to change the culture in an organization, but you can use these principles to create a better working environment at the very least for yourself and your direct reports.
Do you have any stats for percentages of companies utilizing these types of skills and bringing compassion into their workplaces?
You know, it's difficult to find stats. I've looked at a couple of places. So the Greater Good Science Center out of California professes and teaches these principles, and they are finding that there are some relational benefits to revenue, and it kind of differs based on the industry, but they'll see anywhere from a 5 to a 30% increase in revenue. The other impact that they are seeing a huge change in is the effect on employee retention. And those financially are sometimes challenging to quantify, but in the call center world where I spend a lot of my time and where turnover is really a chronic problem, they're seeing increases of between 10 and 12%. And when you're thinking about folks who employ 100 to 5,000 agents at a time, a 10 or 12% increase is really meaningful to them.
And what percentage of companies are adopting these measures?
It's pretty small. It's on a case-by-case basis. You see, and you'll, the ones that you hear about in the press, you're typically hearing about the folks at the in the C-suite at the executive level who work in these ways. So there was a startup company out of California, and their executive was giving back to them. He forego his bonus, and he spread that bonus across his employees. The gentleman who runs Chobani Yogurt did something very similar. Richard Branson, who runs Virgin, he does similar things and acts with a great deal of compassion. He also gives a lot in charity and makes that a part of their culture. I had a client down in South Carolina that does call center outsourcing, and they spent a lot of time having a compassionate and creating a fun atmosphere for their employees, and they did it for selfish reasons. They did it because it's a really competitive marketplace, and they were losing employees very quickly, and it didn't take much. It took like a 50 cent an hour difference in wages to make them jump from one place to another, and they were really struggling with it. So they looked at the employee base, who they were, what age they were, and they had a lot of college students. And so they decided they needed more fun and a more giving culture. So they had regular food drives. They put in a basketball court. They had barbecues once a month, and they let the people get off the phones and come out and participate in the barbecues. And they could play basketball on their breaks. And they had these events around giving. It wasn't just a food drive. It was a whole event where the employees were welcomed into the organization to which they were giving. And they found that those activities alone, which cost them very little money, had a huge impact. They became the number one place where the college kids wanted to work. instead of jumping from job to job.
It brings to mind Starbucks, Facebook, and Google. I mean, organizations like Facebook and Google. Do I have that right? And do you think that millennials are kind of pushing us in that direction?
I do. They tend to want, at least this is what we're reading, and now they're getting a little older, so we'll see what happens with them. And my niece and nephew are in the professional world, and they're technically millennials too, so I pick their brains occasionally. They're very much valuing work-life balance, so they want to have fun at work. They want to feel as though they can make friends and relationships at work that then that brings into the fun atmosphere. You'll see at Google all different kinds of fun places to sit and time given to skunk works, which would be, you know, just thinking outside the box and coming up with crazy ideas. And that is, in fact, how Google Maps was developed. It was a skunk works project by somebody. I think they give them something like an hour a day that's booked into their calendar, and that's for separating from their daily activities. They can go into one of these playrooms or wherever, and it's just meant for thinking. It's very, very impactful. I mean, so if you can think about how many of us use Google Maps on a daily basis, and that's how Google Maps was created.
Amazing. We're running out of time here, but I want to address one aspect of corporate life and corporate success and corporate careers. You're pretty much told not to be soft or emotional in the workplace. You're pretty much asked to come with your A game, constantly be driving the train toward profitability, and hardness is probably a feature of so many workers in white-collar professions, no less. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and that was a huge conundrum that I worked with when I was doing my laboratory testing of the yoga principles, and I had many conversations with my yoga teacher about this particular topic, because it was never comfortable for me to be a jerk or aggressive. And, you know, that is highly prized in many organizations. And so one of the things that she said that will stick with me forever is to be a compassionate person or an empathetic person does not equate to being a doormat. She said there are times in your life, many times, where you have to be a fierce yogi. It's taking action fiercely to do the right thing. So I played with that at work, and it actually does work. So you will be perceived as someone who stands their ground, who asks for what they want, and who typically gets what they want, because what's happening in the background that you may not be speaking out loud to people is that you've decided what's important to you. And if in this case, if being a compassionate person at work and standing up for what is right, and for me that meant standing up for my employees and my customers first, then I always stood the ground, and I stood the ground fiercely. And then people knew not to mess with me on those two topics, and they didn't. And in exchange, they got really good ideas, a really effective team to work with, and people who met their deadlines and kept their promises. And so as a team, we became known as really the top team in the organization. Don't be afraid to be fierce yogi at work. It works.
We've been talking today with Monica Tarr. She's a customer service consultant who has brought passion to the topic of compassion in the workplace. Thank you so much, Monica, for joining me today.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's a great pleasure.
Monica can be found at loveyourcustomers.com. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40, Conversations with Sima. Thank you so much to the listener for joining us today. And until next time, I hope you take care.